This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. We build the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors. And this week we had a whole range of stuff, starting right back in early medieval times. You should have been out about 10 o'clock last night, something like that. The sky in Aberdeenshire was absolutely fabulous. Quite dark further up, but little feathery clouds just below that. I mean, still very, very high clouds, but what was left of the light was just catching them. So it was as if someone had drawn tiny, very, very fine little white lines across the sky. Beautiful. Morning. I'm standing here under, to be honest, frankly, grey, miserable cloud, here at Beech Grove, relaxing in the Banffshire sunshine this fine Saturday morning, because it's only 40 miles away, and for some reason he seems to live in a completely different climate. Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, there's blue sky, just the clouds breaking up, a gentle wind, blackbirds, thrushes, everything in bloom. I keep on saying this is one of the great times of year to be in Scotland. Anyway, we love hearing what you're up to in the Scottish countryside. Tell us what the weather's like. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. You can text 80295 and your standard network message rate will apply. And you call Finn. He's coiled, ready to go. 08, 08, 05.
Is that what he 90, is? Okay.
92, 95, 00.
Heaps more coming up in the programme. Earlier this week, I was at Deer Abbey finding out about the significance of the Book of Deer, which is actually up here in Aberdeen for a few months on loan from Cambridge University. Plus, just round the corner, I visited a very interesting building in Drinney's Wood, not far from Deer Abbey. It's called the Pitfour Observatory, and that's coming up soon.
Yeah, we've also got the possible return of beaver to the Cairngorms and a trip to see storm petrels at Moosebrock in Shetland. But first, the nation awaits. See if you can guess what this bird is.
Dead simple. Dead simple. Simple.
We probably should have cut that in half to make it harder. Out of doors at bbc.co.uk. Text 80295. Your standard network message rate applies. And call Finn 08 085 92 95 00. And people have started to stop me in the street looking for clues.
Oh, it's better than that. Tell the story about your injection.
Well, first of all, Neil stopped me in Glasgow. I said, "What's the mystery word? I love it." And he said, "One of
There's
his offspring."
Plenty about, more where that came from.
About 10 year old with him. I said, "This is one of the guys that we listen to every Saturday morning."
The 10-year-old looked at you and went, "Yeah, really?"
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, and the nurse who was giving me an injection yesterday poised with the needle above my arm and said, "So what's a mystery bird?"
No pressure then.
No.
Earlier this week, the Scottish Government's Land Reform Minister, Mary McCallum, announced a public consultation on the Scottish Government's Land Reform Bill.
Yeah, the bill will be introduced to Parliament by the end of 2023. But why do we need it? I met up with Callum McLeod, Policy Director at Community Lands Scotland, to find out.
Well, as a lot of people say, land reform is a journey. So this is really a development in terms of that journey. So we need to consult on exactly what that land reform bill is going to contain. And it's a public consultation. It's really important that the public are able to engage in this process. And there's quite a lot of quite significant stuff in terms of what's being proposed by government in relation to that. So it's really important, given the significance of land reform as an area that really cuts across people's everyday lives, that we actually enable people to have that discussion and give their views.
Is there that need? Because there's a lot of community land ownership in Scotland already.
There is some community land ownership in Scotland already.
You're going to say there's a long way to go.
There is. I am going to say that. You'd be unsurprised to hear, Ewan. Of course, there is a good deal of community land ownership in Scotland already, and a lot of community landowners who are doing absolutely fantastic work in terms of the changes they're delivering in their communities. But one of the significant issues, really, in terms of Scotland's pattern of land ownership, and really this bill very much acknowledges that, and the Scottish Government acknowledges that, and Parliament's acknowledged it as well over many years, is that we've got a structural problem with Scotland's pattern of rural land ownership. And that problem is that it's incredibly concentrated. It's incredibly concentrated in the hands of very few private landowners, predominantly. The figures that often get highlighted is, you know, that there are roughly about 400 owners own more than half of Scotland's rural land. Now, that's an issue. That's a structural issue, because there's a very clear link between land ownership and land use, because ownership confers certain rights and responsibilities in terms of what you do with the land, whatever type of landowner you are, actually. And that's really an influential aspect in terms of kind of power relationships. So this is fundamentally about redressing that balance. That is not to say, to be clear as well, that, you know, there are not positive things that are being undertaken by private landowners and by every other type of landowner. But it's a structural issue. And I think this bill, in terms of its proposals with regard to a public interest test on significant land transfers and sales, in terms of its need for a public notification process when large-scale sales are happening, because a lot of these sales or transactions are happening off-market. That's a significant element, as is the move to have a statutory legal underpinning to the Land Rights and Responsibilities Statement that was introduced in the 2016 Land Reform Act, amongst other things.
There's a lot in there. I mean, if we look at the public interest aspect of it, would that mean it wouldn't automatically go to the highest bidder? It would be controlled by what's in this for the people of Scotland?
I think that's right. And I think we need to focus on actually having land being used more in the public interest rather than benefiting individual interests in some respects, and just getting the balance right in relation to that, so we get that done. So I think introducing more of a public interest focus in relation to that is very much about balancing these different dimensions. And a lot of that will be driven by the specific context of the situation itself, of course.
The size, the amount of land that some individuals hold has always been controversial, but there's a suggestion that they might want to cap how much one individual could own.
There is a proposal from government, in fact it's probably the headline proposal in terms of what's in the bill, with regard to any significant transfer of land, and the suggested level of that is 3,000 acres. If there's something of that or above, then that should be subject to a public interest test. Now, interesting that you raise that issue about the overall amount of land that individuals can hold, because that's not there. And I think that requires some consideration as well, not least because when the 2014 government-appointed Land Reform Review Group published its report, The Land of Scotland and the Common Good, it actually categorically said, amongst a whole host of different recommendations, that capping the total amount of land that one individual should have is something to be looked at. Rural land in Scotland over centuries has been shaped by visions of how it should be used and by whom. And for what purposes. Now, we'd really need to, and I think this bill is an opportunity to do that, we'd really need to actually empower communities themselves to have a significant voice in terms of what the balance of interests are and whose vision actually counts and matters in terms of doing that. And actually, what's very interesting, I think, as well, in the foreword to the consultation process by the Minister for Land Reform, Murray McCallan, is she makes very clear that for her, she wants to see rural places not having people displaced from the land by these kind of other agendas. So it's really important that when we think about how we address the climate emergency. And this consultation is framed, its title I think is Land Reform for a Just Transition Nation. I think making that just transition to a net zero economy is a pretty fundamental issue. Community Land Scotland advocated quite strongly when the government appointed Just Transition Commission was put in place to ensure that land reform was central to that process, and thinking about who owned land and how they used it actually was central to that process as well.
Are we on the cusp of a big change here, or has it got the potential just to be a talking shop, just a consultation?
I think it's really, really important that this is not just a talking shop. And it's not a dusty consultation that can just be put onto the shelf and ignored. I don't think that should happen. And if there's a genuine commitment on the part of government and parliament to actually deliver step change in terms of who benefits from land reform. And let's be clear as well what we mean by land reform. We mean changes to land ownership and land use in the public interest. Now, in terms of addressing the climate emergency, in terms of actually delivering on community wealth building principles, one of which is the socially just use of land, it's very important that we actually ensure that happens.
Callum McLeod there, Policy Director at Community Land Scotland there. Do you get the feeling there's a real ambition with this?
Yeah, there is. There's a real momentum. But there's so much in there, it's trying to distill it all down. The kind of takeaway points for me were the transparency issue. Mm-hmm. A lot of estates never even come to market. So if they don't come to market, then local people don't have the opportunity to say, well, we might like to have a community buyout here or an asset transfer. And for the benefit of the community, and that's a whole different, you know, that sets us apart from many parts of the world. Is there a public benefit in this transaction?
Remember, we went to Norway, when was it, 2016, I think it was. And one of the things that fascinated me about that was because land ownership is much, much more common there. You know, they don't have these enormous estates as exist here in Scotland. You know, as Callum quoted, it's something like 400, 450 people own 50% of all the privately owned land in Scotland. That doesn't happen there. Therefore, the democratic engagement is much, much stronger at a local level because it matters. You know, if decisions are being made which are going to affect directly where you live, you know, and it's your place, you care.
A simple thing. You have to farm the land to buy a farm.
Yes.
And that doesn't strike me as rocket science.
No, exactly. Occasionally... I say occasionally. I think I've done it twice.
Journalistic exaggeration.
Yes, slight journalistic exaggeration. You know, coming in here, you know, first thing in the morning, I've actually nipped down to the beach and gone into the sea. It is heart-stoppingly cold a lot of the time, but, you know, you do feel absolutely fabulous afterwards. I mean, it really kind of wakes you up first thing in the morning. I do other times, but, you know, not just heading here into the programme. But, you know, it's really popular with folk.
It's growing and growing and growing. It's just the thought of on the way to work at 5 o'clock in the morning popping into the sea. I'm very impressed. Later on in the programme, we'll hear from expert outdoor swimmer Callum McLean. Helen went to meet him recently at the Loch of Cluny near Blair Gowrie.
When she arrived, and before Callum did, I think, there were three ladies just about to go into the water. Lisa, Carol and Jane explained to Helen why they do it.
Just enjoy the outdoors and the cold water, and it's very, very beautiful here.
It's absolutely lovely. I've never been here before, and I'm noticing you've got swimming suits on, like me too. You haven't gone for the wetsuit.
I started off in a wetsuit last April, but now the weather's getting warmer and the water's getting slightly warmer, I'm being brave.
What is the appeal for you?
I was swimming in a pool, and then when it was locked down, I couldn't go swimming. Really missed it. So started going outside, and now I won't go back in a swimming pool.
Do you go swimming all year round outside?
Yes.
In the swimming costume?
No. When it's colder, wetsuit. But Jane's been swimming longer outside, and she actually is going all year round in a swimming costume.
Even in the winter, you're here? every week?
Well, we've just started coming here, but we've been going, we're usually in the sea, but we've been in the sea all year round. So, but now we'll start coming here, I think, more now we've found this place.
Yes,
year round,
it seems like a pretty good place. Now, you, you have got the wetsuit on, but this is actually your first time.
It is. It's my maiden voyage.
And what has enticed you? What have these ladies done to persuade you to come with them?
I just know, I've known Lisa for some time, and I just heard her talking about it, and she enjoys it so much and feels so good after it. I thought I'd give it a go.
It's become a bit of a thing, hasn't it? Especially amongst women.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it's amazing for what it does to you, to how you feel.
Instantly?
Yes. It's just fab. I can't think of a word to describe it, but yeah, you really do feel
buzz.
A really good buzz.
It's a real buzz.
And it lasts. It's not just sort of like over once you get out. That buzz lasts for days.
Do you think actual days then?
Yeah, for me, definitely.
So describe how you feel now and then how you might feel afterwards.
I can feel sort of quite moody and quite down, but once I've been in there, my mood's much better. And if I've got anything bothering me, which at the moment is quite a lot, then the swimming really helps. And not actually just swimming, just being in the water.
How long do you spend in there?
About 20 minutes.
Yeah, 20 minutes to half an hour, depending on how cold it is. When it was really cold, I was about 8 minutes, but now it's getting warmer, about 20 minutes to half an hour.
And is it partly the exercise as well? Because I know when I do enjoy a swim, so you're preaching to the converted here. But I don't go for a big sort of power swim or anything. It's more just the actual sensation of being in the water.
Yes, definitely. Definitely the feel of the water over the skin is, for me, now I've lost the wetsuit, the feeling of the water on the skin is just amazing. Yeah.
So how are you feeling?
I'm excited and nervous altogether. I'm looking forward to it, and hopefully one day I'll be standing in my costume going away and the sun will be shining.
Next week?
Hope so.
Well, I'll leave you to it. You don't mind me recording you going in, do you?
No.
You'll hear lots of screams.
Yeah,
probably.
That's fine.
And Lucy loves it too.
Yeah, the dog is part of it as well.
Oh, yes,
does she
yes.
come actually swimming with you?
Yes, she does, yes. But she tends to spend more time watching and guarding us than she does coming in.
Yeah.
But she does come in sometimes as well.
Excellent.
Yeah, just when we come out, we throw the ball for her and then she'll go swimming.
And you've got your floats with you as well?
Yes, always have a tow float.
Is that just for safety?
For safety, so that you can be seen if there's any boats or anybody out and about. And also, if you get into difficulties, you're spotted much easier.
And I notice as well, I'm not trying to hold you back, that you've actually got a swimming cap on too.
Yes.
That, have you?
Same
and
reason.
You've got the shoes on.
I've got the shoes on because this is very stony, so it hurts your feet.
And the cap for...?
The cap, mainly because I don't like water getting in my ears, and also so that you can be spotted if there's any difficulties.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, go and enjoy. Oh, thank you, dog.
Oh, yes. Lucy will like to do that.
Excellent. All right, have fun.
Will do.
Yeah. Off they go. How is it? It's all right?
Warm.
Good. Well, it's an absolutely beautiful freshwater loch, which I've never been to before. I can see a couple of swans over there preening themselves, and the loch is surrounded by trees, a mixture of broadleaf trees. And it's just nestled into the hills of Perthshire here. Wonderful. We're going for it. In they go. So far, so good.
So far, so good.
Excellent.
Brilliant.
Yay.
Lisa, Carol and Jane at the Loch of Cluny near Blairgowrie. And Helen tells us that Carol's first outdoor swim was an absolutely roaring success and she's hooked. It's maybe just my imagination, but I am convinced that many, many more women swim outdoors than men do.
It appears to be that way. Hesitate to ask, but are women more insensitive to the cold? I don't know.
But better at dealing with pain, I would imagine.
Well, better at dealing with pain, obviously.
Because obviously we're quite sensitive, really.
Well, gentle souls. No, there does seem to be an awful lot more women doing it, which is great. It's just that heart-stopping numbness when you get into the cold that scares me.
Yeah, I'm quite impressed by the 20 to 30 minutes. 20 to 30 seconds as you slip out. Run in, yeah. Run straight back out again. Stay tuned to hear Callum McLean talking about his approach to outdoor swimming, because he's done it more than twice.
Yeah, with a few mystery guesses so far. I thought we'd be inundated with correct answers because it's so, so simple. Anyway, what do we know? Bobby and Wormit thought it was a grey heron. I can see where you're coming from. And Hugh and Orkney thought it was a moorhen. No, I'm not really getting that. But have a listen to it. It's really easy. You'll hear one around you most of the time. Quite distinctive, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's quite. I mean, you can hear them in the background here at the moment. Oh, you did, needless to say, well, until the microphone went live again.
So it's a blackbird then?
Yes, something along those lines. This is one of my favourite comments ever. This is from Joyce and Rossi, who says, "We've had terrible weather for the last few weeks in Butte, and I used to live in Montrose, so I know what the East Coast weather is like. It's only being so resolutely cheerful it keeps Joyce going, really."
Montrose has got good weather, isn't it? Or is that what
she's
saying?
That's not bad. Well, I'm not sure what she's saying, other than the fact they've had really terrible weather for the last few weeks in Butte. And Helen Rogers in Edinburgh was interested to hear the reports from Ness and John Ray last week. She's been up in Orkney for the first time and was walking about the streets, saw the memorial to John Ray in St. Magnus Cathedral, and I think it's a great idea to restore John Ray's childhood home. She says Orkney is such an amazing place, and that is true. No question on that.
Absolutely, and that wee memorial. It's just lovely walking down the street in Stromness, and you see the fountain where the ships used to come in to stock up with fresh water before they used to take off to the Arctic. Mm-hmm. Absolutely steeped in history and so unspoiled. A story that needs to be told, because he got the short straw.
Well, certainly John Ray did, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, later in the programme, we're going to be hearing about the Book of Deer. There's been a lot of excitement. It went on display in Aberdeen Art Gallery. And when I was recording that piece at Deer Abbey, not a million miles away from there, is a place called Pitfour Observatory in Drinney's Wood. Now, I'd heard of the observatory. I've passed the sign umpteen times, but I'd never actually visited it. And it turned out that getting there was going to be a wee bit tricky because of... there's been an awful lot of storm damage. Obviously, Storm Arwen brought down a lot of trees, and it is in the middle of a wood. But I needn't have worried, as the guy I was meeting, Bill Cruikshank, had come well prepared.
Most of the access to the woods were all devastated. All the roads were blocked and so on. Forestry have been in, but from the car park here up to the observatory is still blocked. So we're going to take a long way around, if you like.
In this little Kubota thingy.
It goes through everything.
I'm delighted to hear it. Well, let's get going then.
Right.
Quite noisy as well.
It's a little on the noisy side, I'll grant you that. This little thing has got a sort of like a roll cage, which is fine because we're actually just going underneath a fallen tree at the moment. Needles flying in all directions.
No, that's new.
It's a new one, is it?
Yep. You
have
to watch your head.
We're both ducking to get under this. I tell you, I'm awful glad you know where you're going.
Now, this is the car park road. And it goes away around, but that's all blocked up that way.
Okay. Instead of which, we're actually going to drive up. This doesn't look like a track to me so much as a fire break.
Well, this is an old road that came from Pitfour House.
Okay.
And some poor kitchen maid used to have to walk all the way up here, up to the observatory, and she could light the fire so that the laird could come up and then look across his policies.
Those were the days.
The Pitfour estate would have been quite big. There's a good story. You were at Deer Abbey before this. Did you notice the bridge at the end?
Yes.
There's a little bridge.
Aye.
And it's got two widths. And the reason for that is when Arden, when it was bought by the Russells, there wasn't a bridge there before, so they would each pay half and build their own half. But because the Russells weren't so rich as the Fergusons, the carriage was bigger. The Russell's one was smaller.
Okay.
They built it that size. And then, of course, the Ferguson's one was a lot bigger. So that's why it's two widths.
we're coming to the end of this road and there's a clearing, and inside the clearing there is this structure, the observatory, and I would never have found this in a month of Sundays without your help, Bill. Not a chance.
But this is us here now.
Okay.
If you can imagine... I'll switch this down. If you can imagine this, all these trees were flat. It was all cut down in 1989, 90. I could sit in my living room and watch people walking up a hill to come up to the observatory. So here we are, again, 30 years on. The trees now, you can't see out of the top.
Can't see a blind thing. Come on, we'll go out and have a shifty at it. What kind of observatory was this? What was it for?
From the top, the Laird could see all across his policies, everything that he sort of owned or whatever. So he could see that everybody was doing what they were supposed to be doing and so on. It stands about, I think it's about 80 feet.
It's an extraordinary structure. What is it, octagonal? And it's Harald, which is unusual in and of itself.
Well, the fact of that is that, you see, it was a ruin.
So they patched it up and hurled it. And although there are viewing windows there, I take it that's not original period, authentic double glazing.
The inside the inside has changed from what it was.
Can you get into it nowadays?
Aye, we've got the keys.
Well, let's go for it.
Now, when we go into the entranceway, all the centre here, there's a cylinder structure where with a revolving the spiral staircase going up to the very top.
Okay.
There's a stair behind you here, which is the middle level.
Okay.
But before, as I say, there was three levels, not just the two. And as you see, sometimes when you see repairs done, there's like little hatches blocked off. These were storage rooms.
Let's head right up to the top and see if we can get see what sort of view exists at all. Let's go right up there. I'm laughing because we're 80 feet up in a purpose-built observatory and all we can see is trees, because the trees are about 100 feet. There isn't a view in one single direction.
One bit just so you see...
There?
There, that's very...
You can see about 2 square inches of the horizon.
In the horizon, when you were standing here... In the horizon before, you can actually see up out into the North Sea. And about 7 o'clock at night, you could watch the Shetland Ferry.
See, these trees will come down again in time, and then the view from here is going to be stunning.
Oh, just exactly. Stunning's a word. Can you see right round the northeast? If you look at the viewing plates for your information... That's exactly what you do see. Yeah. And I mean, you see right to Huntly.
This is what you could see if there weren't trees in the road.
Yes.
Yeah, so Peterhead, Bottom Station, Power Station, Crimond Airfield.
St. Fergus Gas Terminal.
That's it. Rattrahead Lighthouse. If we were actually facing this, it would be south. So Mintlaw, Arden Country Park, Achy Bray and Benicay Foothills. And then this one to the west. Benicay. Could you see Lochnagar from here?
Yep.
Wow. I'm glad they restored this.
1993, it was actually opened. It was 92, it was rebuilt and so on. But officially opened by my father, by the way.
Was it, would you? excellent. And this pole that's going up through the roof, is that a flagpole?
Flagpole.
All right, okay.
And the saltire usually flies there, but since COVID and what have you, again, there's not, you get up through a little hatch here. The flag hasn't been up. So, and that, of course, that was the fireplace. Look at the maid had to come up and light.
Schlep up the lane.
But as I say, these were all storerooms. And so these would have been full of wood and anything they needed for the Laird coming up and having a look around.
Bill Crookshank there showing me the Pitfour Observatory in Drunnies Wood, and as you heard, access isn't really that advisable unless you've got a wee Kubota sort of pickup truck type thing, as Bill does. A lot of trees down at the moment, and forestry work is still ongoing in the woods themselves.
I love it. You know, we're very privileged. You know, we've built the fourth crossing.
Indeed.
We've flown in biplanes, we've done so much. But I love the fact you can go up that tower and see absolutely nothing. Yes. Everybody's listening in bed saying, bated breath, oh, what exciting, you know.
Here's a place you can't visit. Yes, exactly. There's that lovely Ogden Nash poem. I think that I shall never see a billboard lovely as a tree. In fact, unless the billboards fall, I'll never see a tree at all. You know, it's kind of the reverse at Drinney's Wood. Anyway, coming up, we've got the importance of the Book of Deer, ideas of introducing beavers into the Cairngorms, deliberately this time, and the joys of outdoor swimming.
And, of course, it's still time to guess this week's mystery bird. A clue, it's not a storm petrel. But here's another clip, if you need to hear it again. Now, that has got to be so easy, but Alistair and Elgin managed to get it wrong. Good morning, gentlemen. Fine to be back home after our camping trip to northern France. We were able to continue to hear your dulcets with the help of BBC Sounds.
Excellent.
And now to the matter in hand. You may well think it's easy, but then you know the answer.
That's true. That's Elgin, very true.
I'm going to go with a crow and ask you not to be too harsh.
No, we're not going to be too harsh. Lucky Nickel actually got the correct answer, which I'm not reading out. But he adds, regarding outdoor swimming, I think it's absolutely true that women can tolerate cold water better than men. Recently, my wife and myself were swimming at Loch Oanye without wetsuits. My wife was in the water for about 20 minutes, but my gentle and soft soul could only manage about 1 minute. That's Lucky on holiday in Loggy Coldstone. Yeah, I remember watching an experiment years ago, actually, that showed that women don't tolerate pain better than men, and it was done using cold water.
I think it's just a male excuse to get out the water.
Yeah, I just don't like it.
Gary in Pennycook says, is it a black-backed gull?
Close. Very close.
Anyway, if you know what that is, get in touch. Finn's taking your calls, 08 085 92 95 00, and you can text on 80295, and your standard network message rate applies.
Craig Wilson wanted to know if we've been up to see the turf house at National Trust of Scotland Glencoe. We have not, as a matter of fact. No. They built the turf house there. He says it looks very impressive. If you're planning a visit, go up to Glencoe House in Lochan. There is a rich history relating to Lord Strathcona, who built it for his wife, a native Canadian, landscaped with a variety of Canadian trees, etc. And adds, mystery bird is a rook. Well, I hope the rest of it is more factually correct than the last bit, Craig, because it's not a rook, sadly.
I'm kicking myself here because I was passing the bottom of Glencoe last week.
Oh, for the love of goodness.
You can't know everything.
Well, that's true. Earlier this summer, the Cairngorms National Park Authority announced it had committed to taking a lead role in bringing Eurasian beavers to the park. Beavers now have European protected species status, and as such, the Scottish Government is supporting translocations to establish populations across the country.
Now, we know there are wee pockets of beavers in Scotland at the moment, but I asked Dr Sarah Hensel, Head of Conservation with the Cairngorms National Park, what the history of beavers was in the park.
We know they've been around for about 2 million years, looking back at the fossil record. And in Scotland, they were around until the late sort of 15th century, early 16th century. And in England, around until late 18th. But we know that they were hunted to extinction because of the valuable beaver pelts. So they're meant to be here.
So it wasn't a lack of habitat that caused them to disappear?
No, not at all. The habitat in the Cairngorms in Scotland is perfect for beaver. It was simply our desire for beaver pelts.
Now, government policies changed in regard to beaver. Nature Scot are going to be implementing it. What's changed? What's the future?
So beavers were given European Protected Species status, which is a real step forward. And then in 2019, government said that they would actively support translocation of beavers both in and without of their current range. So that's a really big step, and that's what we're reacting to with our National Park Partnership Plan and our approach to beavers in the park.
So Nature Scot are looking for applications from people to... Well, here we are beside the Spey. No expert, but it looks like proper beaver country to me.
Yeah, so Nature Scot at the moment, they're going through a process of writing a national beaver strategy, which will set out their plan for the next 10 years over how beavers will be reintroduced to new areas and the mechanisms in terms of governance structures, in terms of the licence application, in terms of mitigation and management. So that'll set out the approach. And then the National Park Authority are then going to decide how we're going to tackle that through taking a leadership role.
So does that mean you're going to apply to have beavers? Because your board have already kind of given you the green light to a certain extent.
Yeah, so our board have agreed and support us taking that proactive role in bringing beavers back to the park, which is fantastic and very exciting. And that will include putting an application in to have beavers in the park, following really extensive stakeholder consultation and lots of information gathering and sharing.
Because there's a school of thought that thought, well, you know, beavers are in Tayside, they're now in the Firth of Forth catchment area. They would have got here eventually.
Yeah, so we commissioned a piece of work. So we've got a Cairngorms Beaver Group with lots of different representation on that group. And we commissioned a report looking at the likelihood of beavers getting to the park naturally in the short term. And the result of what that was that there are too many barriers in place for it happen to happen in the short term, whether it's inhospitable habitat, hydro schemes or dams, so unlikely to get here on their own naturally. Another key part of that report looked at how suitable Cairngorms is for beaver. And as we stood here, yeah, it looks absolutely fantastic. But the statistics and the analysis behind that has shown us that 30% of watercourses in the park are highly suitable for beaver, and 20% of those would be suitable for damming.
There's been a lot of criticism from certainly the farming community down in Tayside about the conflict between beaver and their crop production, which is justifiable. Are you taking that head on? Are you taking it gently with people? Are you speaking to landowners? Are they concerned?
So I think the key thing is that we're taking a leadership role in the national park, and that's alleviating quite a number of concerns, because we're going to take a whole park view to beavers, not just individual sites or individual catchments, a whole park-wide approach. We're not rushing into anything, and we're going to make sure that our decisions are made on solid scientific information. We'll learn from others, both in Scotland and European studies as well, and share that information with landowners and land managers so they're well informed. And of course, we're in the process of recruiting a beaver officer, so we'll have a dedicated member of staff who can support landowners, farmers and communities through this whole process, before, during and after.
Potentially, there's less possibility of conflict in the Cairngorms. It's a very different agricultural ecosystem out here.
It is. And one of the key things we're going to be doing is looking at opportunities. Opportunities for benefits of beaver, but also looking at areas where there could potentially be conflicts. And there are lots of low conflict areas within the Cairngorms, and that's been part of the information that we've been gathering together. And we'll form part of the stakeholder engagement process as well, which I'll add will be on a whole catchment level rather than just a site. So we'll bring in the thoughts and opinions of farmers, landowners and fisheries and communities as well.
Because there's a fair number of these trees will come down if you've got beaver here.
There is. I mean, that's the balance.
That's not the end of the world, though.
It's not. Beavers, as we know, and they're referred to widely, they're an ecosystem engineer. So, of course, there will be some areas where trees along riparian edges may be felled, but effectively they're going to be coppicing. So there's going to be lots of regeneration, and the benefits of beavers certainly outweigh any negative, small, short-term impacts.
And flooding as well. You know, big impacts of flooding downstream from here. Presumably, well, it's been said many times, it reduces the potential for flooding. It doesn't fix it.
Of course, yeah, again, I'm going to go back to this point of them being an ecosystem engineer. They add heterogeneity or variety to ecosystems. They alleviate flooding through slowing water flow down, improving water quality as well. So, yeah, that ecosystem engineer, and definitely help with flood management.
What's it going to be like? And I've asked quite a few people this over the years. You come down to Loch Morlock and you see beavers swimming across the loch on a summer evening.
It's magical. I mean, it's such an exciting time, and an exciting time for me to be working in the Cairngorms National Park as well. And many of us are really, really excited and share that excitement and enthusiasm, because what a wonderful sight that would be. We'll have more natural systems, more natural ecosystems that are restored and functioning better. And that's so important. We're at a time where we've got a climate change emergency. We've got biodiversity decline at a rate that we've never seen before. And we've got an opportunity to bring back a keystone species that is going to be not only wonderful to see, but perform a really important function.
Dr. Sarah Henschel there, Head of Conservation with the Cairngorms National Park Authority.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I mean, there will be farmers shouting at me, there will be foresters shouting at us, but they're supposed to be here. We took them out, we should put them back.
No, I've actually sat and watched them, not terribly far away from Dunkeld, and just there's just something...
it's really hard to explain, you know, the sort of impact they have when you actually see them in the environment. There's a rightness about it.
And it depends where they put them in the national park, assuming they're successful. Because if they put them on the east side, then they'll go down the Dee and the Don, presumably.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you might have beavers outside your office in Peachgrove Terrace, Aberdeen.
You never know. You never know. We've been talking a lot about curlews over the past few months here in Outdoors. Now, they're not faring so well here in Scotland. Now, we have curlews where I stay. I live, you know, basically rural Aberdeenshire, overlooking the Buchan Plain. It's classic territory. It's quite well farmed. So, you know, it's the kind of place that they like to be. Now, there's one particular curlew that was up in one of our top fields. I know this sounds weird, but having observed it quite closely for a few weeks, I got the distinct feeling it might be lonely.
It's taking to perching on a strainer post up in our top field, and it'll sit there for hours on end, and I've been able to get quite close to it, and it'll sort of whicker to itself. It's not very happy if I get a bit too close. Here it comes again. But recently, if I've been in amongst the horses, it will not only land in the same field, it'll actually start to come towards you. And I've never seen a curlew do that before. Just flew down the hill there, and it's landed in the field below me, and it's raining quite heavily at the moment. It's a wading bird, it doesn't care less. I see its head and that long bill just making its way through the long grass. It's taken off again, but it's almost as if it wants the company. And perhaps more worryingly still, I've only ever seen the one. I think that was one of a pair that was nesting in the field, two fields away, if that makes sense. But that was cut for silage. And I wonder if it lost its mate and its chicks. I mean, they're very, very unprepossessing birds. This one's a bit sort of paler, a bit greyer than normal. I mean, it's just normally a large brown bird with its really long, curved bill. But the sound they make just... well, I love it. I sleep with the window open, and it will wake me at night. But at the best of times, it's a lonely call. And when your imagination starts to work on a backstory like this one, it's worse.
It's got everybody greeting over their wheaty bangs this morning.
Yeah. It's just a really haunting sound that, interestingly, it has moved from our top field, maybe about four fields away. It's down on a neighbour's farm now. But it's doing exactly the same thing. It's perching up on a strainer post and just sitting there calling.
Looking for a mate.
It possibly is. Possibly is.
And, of course, you should be practising environmentally friendly silage cutting, starting in the middle of the field and working to the edges.
Mm.
That way you don't kill all the birds. Not rocket science, it's easy to do. Start in the middle, work towards the edge, and the birds will get driven to the edge.
Well, certainly that was the practice with things like corncrakes.
Corncrake, you know, more of a curlew as well.
Yeah. Well, possibly it would.
Any ground nesting bird.
Well, it depends on the age of the chicks, I would have thought, too, because, you know, whether the chicks would actually be able to outrun it in thick... I just don't know.
I don't know, it's been possibly entirely my imagination, but it just made a real impact on me. We're into the summer holidays now, and everything's looking spectacularly green and vibrant. Although, to be honest, up here we could do with a bit more rain. Currently happening across the country is something called Dandelion. It's a six-month creative celebration driven by the concept of sow, grow, share. Joining us now to tell us more is Neil Butler, Dandelion Director of Festivals and Events. Tell me a bit more about Dandelion. Where did the idea come from?
Well, Dandelion is a project to encourage people to sow, grow and share food. And it came about because there was a call out for teens to get together from across various of the STEAM sectors, so from science, technology and engineering, arts and maths. And myself and a group of people from across those sectors got together with a sort of shared concern about the climate emergency and food poverty and what had happened, I guess, across Scotland going through COVID. And put together a project called Dandelion, which was essentially to encourage people to think about where their food came from and to think about maybe growing their own food and sharing it. And we put that bid into the Scottish Government and Event Scotland, who are the commissioners of the project, and we're lucky enough to get it. And for the last year or so, we've been sort of working with now over 100 people and many, many organisations to present the project across Scotland. Most recently, in a sort of quite a large festival that took place in Kelvingrove Park in Glasgow. But over this weekend, today I'm getting ready to go to Falkirk, where we're going to be giving away thousands of plant plugs. And we've been doing this in the end in 21 different locations, from the north to the south of Scotland and from the west to the east.
Is this a big concept, or are people capable of just having two plant plugs on a windowsill, or has it got to be a bigger scale? Because if you want to grow, share, and grow and share, does it need to be on a bigger scale?
No, not at all. I mean, I think a part of the reason we call it Dandelion is that inspiration of what in this country some people call what we call dandelion a weed, but in other countries it's seen as a precious flower. And the thing about a dandelion is it's very beautiful, but when it disperses its seeds, they can appear anywhere. And it's the idea of this gave us the idea of unexpected gardens where it's just as good to be growing on your windowsill as it is to be if you've got a little bit of garden, or maybe find a piece of land quite close by where it's possible to grow plants. And we just had this idea that it'd be wonderful to find unexpected gardens across the country. And some of them are on a quite a big scale. The other day I was up in Alness, which is just above Inverness, and there's an amazing garden which has been created by the organisation up there, Faith Ross. And it's on quite a big scale, and they have music, and they have they've got a stretch tent there, and lots of children come in there every day. While other in my garden, I must confess, I'm not a brilliant gardener. I'm learning every day. I've got a very modest garden, but we've got borders some chives, we've got some lemongrass, we've got some tomatoes growing. So it can be really on any scale.
We saw one of your cubes of perpetual light at the Royal Highland Show, and that was fascinating because it was, you know, it's only a metre square. Tell me about them and where can people see them?
Well, they were sort of a critical part of the project in the sense that we wanted to think about future ways of growing and the idea of getting involved with schools in experimenting with different ways of growing it. And as you say, the cubes are like 1 meter square. They grow plants on trays hydroponically in water, and they grow under light. And over 100 of these have been put into secondary schools across Scotland. And we've got altogether, I think, 468 schools in Scotland doing experiments either with these cubes or with growing potatoes. And in addition to that, we thought, well, these cubes are so beautiful, we could turn them into art objects. And so we put them together with installations and working with our music director, Donald Shaw of Celtic Connections and Catacaly, commissioned musicians from across the world, some working with Scottish musicians, to create music. So what then happens is that if you go to, for instance, the V&A or you go soon in Edinburgh to the Edinburgh International Film Festival, or you go to the Botanics up in Inverness, you'll discover in the V&A, for instance, there are 12 of these cubes arranged in a square, and they're very beautiful. There's a whole light sequence going on, and there's music, and it's quite an immersive experience because the music is quadraphonic. It's coming from four different directions. So there's quite a wide range of places you can see these cubes. You could also, if you went down to the canals today, to the Kelpies, you would see them on our floating garden. Now, the floating garden was a sort of poetic idea, the idea of floating a garden from Glasgow through to Edinburgh, which essentially comprised of two or three vessels, one of which is very much like an allotment, a floating allotment, and another is made by a company called Biomatrix, which is essentially an eco garden, a floating eco garden, where the plants get nutrients out of the canal water and grow, and in the process of drawing the liquid out of the canals, they also cleaned the canals. So if you were today to go along to the Kelpies, you would see this beautiful floating garden, and on the floating garden you'd also see some of our cubes. So you'd have a whole range of methods of growing, from these incredible sort of futuristic hydroponics and the canals through to traditional allotment growing under the greenhouses and raised beds.
I find it fascinating that you've got essentially various different methods of growing, and you're involving so many people, etc. And you've got this interesting mix between sort of, you know, science and engineering and maths and arts at the same time. Presumably, this is all heading towards a particular point of harvest, is it?
That's right. I mean, the whole project is aiming towards a period in 9th, 10th, 11th of September, when all those participating schools and all the other organisations we've been working with across Scotland will have a harvest event, harvest festival, to celebrate the food that's been grown and to share. Yeah. And I think that the sort of key idea behind harvest is to it's also bringing back what happened during the pandemic, when communities got together, when people looked after each other. And it's the idea of thinking, well, if you can grow food or you have food, who would you want to share it with? Yeah. So that the sort of the big message of the harvest events, which anybody can hold, that anybody can get involved in.
I think it's an excellent idea, that kind of thing, because it brings so many people together. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Neil.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Neil Butler there from Dandelion. And if you'd like to find out more about what's going on, there's a link to the Dandelion website from ours.
Yeah, and those cubes of perpetual light are absolutely fascinating. I really, really want one. And they're beautiful to look at.
Yes, they are. You're listening Down to Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
You can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listen to it. You can email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Richard and Mary in Exeter did. They said, "What an interview with June Nelson." That's yet another book we've ordered following your programme. In recent times, that follows Alice Morrison and Morocco, Nan Shepherd's Living Mountain, Island of the Edge by Anne Shalowa, and Stephen Rutt's Wintering. You've also started to infiltrate our phones with podcasts, previous episodes of Scotland Outdoors, and the Peak Finder app. With a success rate, we hope you're on commission. Sadly, no.
But it's a very, very good idea.
Yeah.
She goes on to say, a few weeks ago you mentioned dogs being required to be kept on leads in Norway during the nesting season. This is required down here on Dartmoor from the 1st of March until the end of July because the nesting birds and lambing. As a keen dog walker and birder, this seems the way to go. Although our dog Bailey is so well trained, of course, he would never ever chase a bird. That's Richard Mandy and Bailey in Exeter.
Next month is the Edinburgh Festival and Fringe, and basically we are going to bring you some exciting news now. If you'd like to be in the live audience for Out of Doors from our Spiegel Tent venue located at St James Quarter in the centre of Edinburgh, you can apply for tickets now.
Yeah, the tickets will be distributed by a random draw, and you can apply at any time up until 11:55 on Monday the 25th of July. Just go to, I'm going to say this twice, just go to bbc.co.uk/shows and tours, and head to the shows section of the site and search for Edinburgh Festivals. The link is also on our programme page. That's bbc.co.uk/shows and tours, but you will have to get up early. Meanwhile, the mystery bird guesses have been coming through. Hey, you got a wrong one here from Ian and Claire. Hi, is the mystery bird a raven? We love listening to you each week from just over the border in Northumberland, where the weather is overcast but dry. That's Ian and Claire. Okay, for the final time, have a listen.
I think it's really quite straightforward. Janet from Perth has got it wrong. It says, is today's mystery bird a chip-stealing seagull? Not actually a technical term, but fair enough. It's close. Beautiful day today, so I'm heading home to Kinloch Rannoch, lunch at Rannoch Station Tea Room, yum, and maybe if I'm brave enough, a swim in Loch Rannoch. Keep up the good work. Love the programme. Susie from Spotford was a grey heron. Keith Sutherland and Blair Gowrie, blackback gull. Jock and Macrahanish, the chip-stealing common gull. Nope. Close though. Keith in Hertfordshire, mystery bird and Arctic tern. Davy in Renfrew, if the blackback gull is very close for the mystery bird, is it a lesser blackback gull? You're too clever for us, Davy. My out of doors day today is helping George, a cleverer guy than me, to build a catootery, which is an outdoor cat house for my partner Joe's four cats, Pud's, Bed, Nala, and Poppy. It's going to be a long, hot day, and I hope the cats appreciate it. Why, you can only live in hope. Outdoor swimming's really grown in popularity in recent years. The pandemic had a lot to do with it because swimming pools were shut and folks still had the urge to swim, basically, so they took to rivers and lochs and the sea instead.
Yeah, Callum McLean is a well-known outdoor swimmer here in Scotland. He's made various films for BBC Alibi and is always encouraging folk to have a go.
Now, there is a tradition in many parts for folk to throw themselves into the sea on New Year's Day, even if they don't normally do that kind of thing at any other time of the year, but Callum suggested to Helen, you will enjoy it much more if you actually start outdoor swimming in the warmer months.
Right now is the best time to start outdoor swimming because the water's all right. It's still going to get slightly warmer in Scotland, actually. As it changes temperature, you're already used to it, so you're used to the kind of process and how your body feels, and you get acclimatised over time. Yeah, I mean, cold water immersion has become really popular over the last couple of years. Very similar to swimming, but I think a lot of people who do that, it's all just about being in the water and maybe they're not even actually swimming at all. So I think the two things are very closely connected in terms of safety things. But I'm really interested in, you know, getting people out and maybe actually swimming, you know, around a headland, seeing what's around the corner, having a look, exploring somewhere new, quite literally getting a new, you know, view on a place by being out in the water.
So it's actually more about exploring the landscape.
A lot of that is, yeah, I am really interested in that. I think I get very bored swimming at the same place maybe all the time. And although I really like, you know, when I'm in a city, going to a Lido and having a swim there, I couldn't do that all the time. You know, for me, a lot of the joy of it is, you know, seeing beautiful places, exploring little nooks and crannies, places that I think, looking at a map, oh, that could be quite a nice place to go swimming. So, yeah, a lot of the interest for me is being in a place that really inspires me and makes me feel really cool and makes me feel, like, a bit wowed by it. That's what I really like.
We're sitting here on the edge of a loch. There are many different places that you can swim. You've got the sea, lochs, rivers. Do you have any particular favourites?
I don't know. I think it changes. I really like rivers with clear water, which is sometimes hard to find in Scotland unless it's summer. I really like that, you know, finding a river pool where you can dive in and go for a swim. I don't think I do quite have a preference. Because each one has its own unique thing. For example, here, you've got a beautiful landscape around you, but the water's quite dark, so you don't see much once your face is in the water if you're doing front crawl. But if you're at, like, a beach, you know, you can almost be snorkeling whilst you're swimming, just about. Just because of where I live, I'm kind of a bit landlocked.
Yeah,
so it's not the sea right now. But I do miss the sea, living there, because I'm, like, an hour and a half drive from the sea, so I'm like, ugh.
And is under the water of great appeal to you as well? Are you looking and seeing what you can find?
Yeah, particularly in the sea, I think it's more interesting for that. I've not seen so much wildlife in the lochs underwater. Often they're quite peaty in Scotland, but I have found stuff. I found, like, an ice axe up in the Cairngorms, which must have slid across the loch when it was frozen and then fallen in. Particularly around the sea, so around coastal areas where there's you know, seagrass growing and you can find crabs. And yeah, I was swimming near Applecross a couple of years ago and I found, like, a little crab, so I was like making a little film with him. A lot of being in cold water or being in water really kind of makes me feel, like, quite creative. So it's inspired me to make films or to take photos or something. So I try to do quite a lot of that as well, whether it's just carrying a small camera with me so I can actually swim, or sometimes taking a bigger camera in specifically to get photos of, you know, some of the wildlife underwater. I've not seen enough fish in Scotland. That's the one thing I think. Maybe if you're a diver, you get to see a bit more, but I'd like to see more fish, actually. You know, compare it to, like, Australia. If you go snorkeling, yeah, it's very easy some places to go and see lots of colour and fish. I think in Scotland you have to go diving, really, to see most
deep,
of the stuff.
Yeah, down deep. You're also a Gaelic speaker as well. The Gaelic culture comes from the whole different world and represents landscape in different ways from perhaps the Scots way in Scotland. Is there a tradition of relating to water within the Gaeltacht?
Yes, but I don't know if swimming is so much, actually. It's interesting. I was trying to find some, like, there's like an online digital archive of old, you know, recordings and sayings and things, and I try to find if there's anything connected to swimming. Often out in the islands, for example, the Western Isles, people wouldn't swim, so there's often quite a lot of death from boats and things like that. But there's lots of folklore and tales and things attached to water. For example, here in Perthshire, you've got, near Loch Tay, you've got lots of streams where Uruksks would have lived, the kind of half-goat, half-human creatures. So there's loads of folklore attached to that, and, you know, Gaelic rhymes connected to the names of these things. And there's all sorts of folklore connected with crossing water as well and things like that. And so if you swim at a place where three waters meet, I'm not sure if I've done, I was trying to think the other day. Apparently, yeah, there's healing water there. There's various places in Skye, for example, I can think of one where the water is considered to be healing water, and there's all sorts of healing wells and things connected to the folklore. Yeah, so there's loads of that, and that, I'm really interested in that and finding out more about it. I've got all sorts of ideas to make like a series of films on something, but I always get distracted and end up doing something else.
Yeah, brings to mind the Tours of Ben Ann.
Okay.
Have you been up there?
I've not, actually.
So that's above Tormentel, and then there's amazing tours, and there's these little pools within the rocks, and apparently it was said that women used to be taken up there when they were pregnant to bathe in the water so that they would have a good birth.
Okay. Wow, I didn't know that. Yeah,
that's a cool place to go.
Okay, have you swum there yourself?
Yeah, it's not really like swimming. It's more like just putting yourself in them. It's not really much.
Okay, but I mean, that's sometimes half the fun of it. Just being in the water somewhere.
Yeah, that's it, and that's interesting. You know, you talk about the healing waters. Actually, it's by all accounts that is what it is fundamentally, isn't it? Doing this.
Yeah, I think so, and I think, however you speak about it, that's a lot of what people get from it. You know, they might not consider it or talk about it in that way. Whether it's something deep or whether it's something you get a good feeling, whether you've, you know, achieve a challenge of swimming around an island, people get different things out of it. But I think it really does benefit you more than anything else.
Callum McLean there, speaking to Helen on the banks of Loch Cluny. Callum's got a new book out called 1001 Outdoor Swimming Tips, count them, filled with advice on how to go about it. And you can hear the full conversation between Callum and Helen on the latest edition of Scotland Outdoors, which is available on BBC Sounds. Now, the Isla Musa in Shetland has been alive with activity this month as the world's smallest seabird, storm petrels, return to nest for the summer. The Musa boat runs popular nighttime trips to view these fabulous wee creatures which breed inside the island's 2,000-year-old Iron Age broch. BBC Radio Shetland's Eva Runciman clambered aboard the Solon 4 at dusk to join guide Rodney Smith as he took the visitors across.
So it's the European storm petrel. They did a survey here in 1996, the first time they did a survey. They did another survey in 2008. And the 2008 survey, they said that the population had doubled since 1996, and they believed that at that time there was about 12,000 breeding pairs living on Musa, which is about 40% of the UK's population of storm petrels, which makes this the largest storm petrel colony in the UK. The birds return in May, and the first eggs are laid in June. The eggs take 6 weeks to hatch, and once they've hatched, the birds take a further 10 weeks to fully develop and fledge the nest. So that takes you up to, that's 16 weeks from June. So that's 4 months. And then they'll probably migrate. The adult birds will migrate after that.
Is it the structures like the broch that you think makes Moosa so attractive for these birds? What is it that they like about nesting here?
Well, it's because there is no rats or mice. There's no ground predators here. And that's a favourite spot for them because they're safer. They're safe.
And the broch, you said it was about 50 foot high.
It's 43 foot high, yeah.
So that keeps them quite safe off the ground as well?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And
they're burrowed in quite deep too?
Yeah, there's the broch, the construction of the broch is like a double, it's two stone walls with a cavity between the two. And they can go all the way through the outer wall. There's little places where, you know, the stones are not so tightly built that they can't get all the way. They can go all the way through and inside to the inside. So they're nesting in the outside wall and the inside wall.
So they're cosy.
Yeah, they're very... It probably is, yeah. I mean, there's reckoned to be in the region 300 to 500 breeding pairs living within the walls of the broch. But all over the rest of the island, you know, they're in every old wall and building all over the island, so they reckon the population of the island is in the region of 11 to 12,000 breeding pairs, which makes it the largest colony in the UK.
It's about 11 o'clock at night just now, and it's obviously getting dark, and you said it's darker now because it's overcast. Is this the only time to see them
It's later at night. I mean, they will come back even on a brighter night, but it will be later. They're just doing the best to come back under some cover to try and avoid the predator birds.
And how would you identify a storm petrel? Obviously, we're scanning the edge of the broch to see if we can see them, but if you were to see one up close, what do they look like?
They're quite a small bird, quite long wings, brown in colour, and they've got a white rump.
There's one just gone in.
Yeah. This one's just gone in.
They're tiny.
Yeah, they're not big. They're quite long wings. Oh, they're a lovely bird, like.
We know Shetland's been badly affected by avian flu and Nos Nature Reserve has had to close. How are the storm petrels holding up?
The storm petrels are a very antisocial bird. We haven't seen any effects of the avian flu on storm petrels at all here.
Does it affect the smaller birds less? Because the puffins seem to be doing okay as well.
Yeah, maybe it's because they're quite antisocial. They just, when they go away to feed, the bird that comes back here tonight from its feeding trip, it'll take over the incubation duties of the egg. And the other bird that's been waiting to go to feed, it will have lost maybe up to 20% of its body weight in the time it was waiting, so it's got to go and feed right away. But it's leaving under the same cover of darkness and it's going away out into the sea where there are none of the larger predator birds. They're going 300 to 400 kilometres away from here to feed.
And you said that the tags have showed you that storm petrels, they mate for life and they stay that way.
Yeah, they mate for life. And they nest in the same place as well every year. They're pretty special little guys. And they work together to incubate that egg. I think it's really a lovely story, the way they work together.
And you were talking about their Shetland name. What is the Shetland name for storm petrel?
The Shetland name for storm petrel is Alamuti. So Alamuti. Muti would be the Shetland dialect name for small. And Ala would be the oily. So basically a small oily bird.
And you said they have quite a distinct scent.
Quite a strong oily smell, actually.
And on the way out of the boat, you gave us each a red light, and they're the lights that we can view these tiny birds under.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. They don't recommend flash photography. It can damage the bird's eyes. Or using a white light on the bird, a bright white light, that can also damage the bird's eyes. But if you see a bird on the wall, you can use the red light and you can shine it on the bird just to have a better view of the bird.
How many visitors does the broch attract and the petrels attract every year, would you say?
We'll have 5,000 plus visitors to Moosa in a season.
And coming from fairly far away to see these birds.
Yeah, a lot of people, yeah. It's quite a popular trip. It's really a unique thing to see. You won't see anything like this anywhere else.
and we're waiting for them to return to the broch just now, and we're listening out for that distinctive sound. What did you describe the sound as earlier?
It's described as a churring sound followed by a hiccough. Not my description.
Whatever that might mean, yes.
But if you listen to the water, if you go around and you listen to the wall, or if you go inside the broch, you'll definitely hear it in the broch. Mm. You'll hear it now. I'm surprised that there's no more birds back already, because it is quite overcast tonight. But no, they'll be coming. It's early days yet. Let's have a look. Oh yeah, it's only 12:45. 12:40. But they'll be coming.
They never fail.
They never fail. You see them every night?
I see them every night I'm here. They've never let us down. We've never been a night without birds.
Rodney Smith there speaking to Eva Runciman. Remember hearing them in the walls at St Kilda?
Aye. Wonderful. Eerie, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very sound. And that's a trip I've never done out to Moosa Bronc. I'd love to go.
It's lovely. I'll admire the dedication getting out there at midnight as well.
Yeah. Having said that, it's probably pretty light still at midnight up in Shetland.
Well, that's through summer dim.
Aye, quite. As we've been mentioning this morning, the Book of Deer is on display in Aberdeen Art Gallery from this weekend until the start of October. It's on loan from Cambridge University Library. It's first time in a dog's age that it's returned to the northeast of Scotland, where it's thought to have originated. Now, to find out what makes it so special, I went to meet Derek Jennings and Anne Simpson from the Book of Deer Project at Deer Abbey. First off, I just said to Anne, look, this wee pocket gospel, describe it to me.
It's small, it's not much bigger than my phone. Absolutely amazing artefact that probably should be known better than it actually is in Scotland, because it's probably our most important surviving manuscript from the time. It's a pocket gospel. It hasn't got the huge colourful illustrations that some of the more better known books from that period have, but for me it's very precious because it was, I think, for private prayer and was taken around by the monks because it was handy. It might have slipped into their pocket. And really important, not so much for the fact it's a manuscript with the Latin, but for the earliest known written Gaelic in the margins. And that's what makes it absolutely unique. And that's what brings it here, because in those Gaelic translations are places that are local to Deer.
You've kind of preempted my next question, which was, do we know the Book of Deer was actually written at Deer Monastery?
No, we don't know it was written here, but what we do know is it was annotated here. Those marginalia were drawn, were put into the margins as records of land transactions and others, because the fact the places are mentioned, Auchmacher, Ellen, is it Pitfour, Derek?
Aden.
So we know it was here at one time. Where it was written, we don't know. It could have been written in Ireland and brought here. It could have been written, somebody thinks it could have been written at Port Mahomack up the coast. It could have been, you know, written in another monastery. But we definitely know it was here or hereabouts.
Tell you how daft I am, Derek. I was reading up on this and they said, you know, and they're still hunting for Deer Monastery. And I thought, no. Deer Monastery is just beside the road. Deer Abbey is beside the road. But nobody knows where the monastery is.
I joined the project in 2009, and at that time it was mostly bonded with the Aberdeen University, and it was mostly academic mostly. I have an interest in archaeology, so I suggested at the time we might consider doing archaeology and searching for the monastery of Deer where the book was written. And they were all for it, and we have, until quite recently, researched and dug for the last, we've done about 10 digs. So our stock statement was, we know where it isn't.
Having said that, though, we came here just to try and see what we could find, and did the dig 2018, I think it was, and found certainly some interesting finds. The Neffeltaffel board, which I don't know if you've heard about. Neffeltaffel. Uh-huh. It wasn't a board, it was a stone on which this Viking game had been, a bit like Noughts and Crosses, had been scratched, and it had been used as a top of a pitcher lid, and one of the diggers found that, and that certainly hit the national and international news, because it's quite rare. And that to us meant that, you know, in Viking times there had been something here on this particular site, and the carbon dating at that time, set in terms of pottery, certainly fitted the period that we were looking at. So we were keen to come back. Our archaeologist was Ali Cameron was really keen to come back and do a further dig here. looking for the Monastery of Deer, but basically also just looking at what else was associated with this particular place.
Just to describe this place, Deer Abbey is across there, you know, and you can still see some of the arches, etc. There's lots of ruins across there. This is more a sort of... it's a rock park, this. Essentially, you know, there's lots of weeds in it, lots of grass. You've cleared a huge area, you know, of earth. I mean, it is big. I mean, this is possibly about the size of a couple of tennis courts, something like that. And I only say that because it's Wimbledon on at the moment.
It's certainly the biggest trench that we've put in all the digs so far. That's partly because we had funding from the National Lottery Heritage Fund for bringing the book back to Aberdeen on loan, and for doing a cultural programme to celebrate the return of the book, and also to do another big dig, because we're doing 12 weeks of digging.
You're both local. Why does this excite you?
I've been involved with the Book of Deer since 1990, because I was one of the local community workers, and I heard about it through the Central Buchan Tourism Group, believe it or not, and people felt that this book should be better known, and it just gets under your skin. I'm Catholic, and I just have some kind of spiritual connection with the ideas that at some point the monks here spent their days tilling the soil, making honey, making beer, and writing by candlelight, scribing on something particularly important. And then I think the other aspect, I mean, I'm not a Gaelic speaker, but the fact that we can show that Gaelic was a language that was known in this part of the world just touches me. Yeah, gets under your skin.
How amenable were Cambridge to actually lending you this in the first place?
They were incredibly amenable. We were basically, you know, we were down on a visit to see the book because I'd never seen it. And about 24 of us from the project went down there a few years ago. And I just asked the question of Cambridge, would you be willing to lend us it? Should we be able to get the funding to do that? Yes, they said. But then it's very appropriate because this is the year of Scotland stories. And for me, the Book of Deer is one of Scotland's stories.
How do you transport something that old? How valuable is it? How do you pick what you actually show of it? Because you can't show all the pages.
Cambridge had to pick the courier, and our breath was taken away when they said it'll probably cost about £40,000 to get the book up, to transport it, £35,000 to £40,000, and they put a value on it of eight million pounds. They put a value on it, so we had to have a bespoke case. And because it's bespoke, we are not allowed to open it. Once it's the book is in it...
So you had to pick the page beforehand?
We had to pick the page beforehand. It had to be open at two pages. And we thought maybe that's not very good, being exposed to the light, just the two pages for 3 months open under spotlight. But they said it's special glass and everything. So it's special conditions within this case.
It was really important. And that's why we had to pick somewhere in Aberdeenshire that has the competence to actually look after it. And the Art Gallery and Museum in Aberdeen was the place that we could find that had also easy access for community, because it's, people can drive, you know, get a bus into Aberdeen. The city have been great partners, and we've now got it in the Art Gallery and Museum, and I'm absolutely sure that that's the right place.
I have every intention of going in to see it, because I really want to see it. But the pages that you've picked, what am I going to see? Why did you pick those pages?
Well, the page that we picked, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the most important pages, because we're starting to explore a Viking connection with the book. St. Matthew is one of the pages that we have opened, and he has a Viking sword, and it's coming up at the same time as a Galloway hoard. So this Viking connection and the Galloway hoard, which is also Viking, is a good lead-on and a hook within each other. So
evidence of the Gaelic notes. We had to pick, because of the fact that's what makes it unique to us, it had to be a page where people could actually see the marginalia that we've been talking about.
That was Anne Simpson and Derek Jennings from the Book of Deer Project, and the book's on display in Aberdeen Art Gallery from today. If you can't get down to Aberdeen, there's actually a very good facsimile copy in the museum at Adden Country Park, which I had a look at as well. Just a great story.
I've got a Naffle Tassel game.
Have you?
It's fantastic. I've sent you a photograph of it on Twitter. But the National Museum of Scotland sell boards as well, and it is a fantastic game.
Okay.
Because it's not two evenly matched sides. You know, there's one big attacking army and a defending army, and it's strangely addictive.
Okay, fair enough. Moving on to, you know, basically the whole point of this programme is the mystery bird thing nowadays.
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty well. And we've got some correct answers here from Stuart Taylor in Elgin, Heather from Linlithgow, Ross in Tainault, Katie in Perth, Barb in Shetland, Ian Tully Nessel. Striking look, says Ian, but not universally loved, true. Wendy, greetings from beautiful Montrose, where they are the most popular birds. Is this your mystery bird today? And then Scott Matheson got it correct too.
Yeah, it was, of course, the herring gull. The drumming was incessant. Closer, ever closer. Deep in the earth below, the inhabitants of this dark subterranean world knew and dreaded the approach of impending doom and frantically scrambled for the surface, where awaited an even greater unknown threat. For life as an earthworm is a challenge. On the surface, they are vulnerable to blackbirds, badgers and hedgehogs, but below ground, only the newly arrived threat of the New Zealand flatworm and, of course, the mole. An extensive system of tunnels designed to trap the worms. The moles patrol by day and night, constantly digging to expand the network. And that digging, the sound of claw against earth, is a noise ingrained in the limited brain of the worm that triggers a response to head upwards and to safety. On this occasion, a big mistake. For on the surface, the herring gull is performing a dance. A dance reminiscent of an Irish step dancer. The rhythmic back and forth, tapping away at the damp grass in a seemingly pointless dance. But this is a dance which has evolved over the ages. A dance which is both clever and deadly. Because the step dance of the herring gull replicates beautifully the sound of the digging mole. As the tapping of the feet echoes through the tunnels, the worms panic and present themselves as yet another meal to the waiting gull. Herring gulls aren't the most popular bird in the world, but they are survivors. They are successful. They adapt. They evolve. As other species suffer at the hand of man, they take it on the chin and use us to their advantage. But there is evidence that their numbers are decreasing. Yes, there are tales of thug gulls mugging for chips and ice cream, but they serve a purpose. As scavengers, they clean the street of discarded food, food which would encourage rats and other vermin. Streetlights mean they can patrol at night, seeking out our waste. Extensive means have been deployed to get rid of the assumed irritation of the herring gull. Many methods deployed by mariners in the past are simply too disturbing to regurgitate here. But man has been at war with the herring gull since the first nets were cast and the first hook baited. Spikes on roofs don't work due to the leathery feet of the gull. Destroy the nest, they'll build another. Remove the eggs, lay again. They pair for life, and they can live up to 50 years of age. If a predator appears, they rise en masse, even if it's just one chick under threat. And on occasion, it's often the bird of prey that ends up losing its life. In Mormon mythology, the early settlers of Utah's first crops were going to be wiped out by locusts, dooming the settlers to starve. But miraculously, an enormous flock of gulls descended upon the locusts and ate them all before the crops were touched. Here, seagulls are seen as the hand of God, and the gulls have been venerated as Utah's state bird. In Wales, they foretell a storm. In some Native American tales, they were the keepers of light, which they locked up in a cedar box till the ravens attacked and broke open the seal and gave light to the world. The herring gulls don't eat much in the way of herring. It's thought the name comes from the silvery plumage, like that of a herring, tipped with black, and the bird with a distinctive red dot on the beak. The spot where the young will tap in hunger, which triggers the regurgitation of a fish supper, a kebab, or even, on occasion, a herring or two to satisfy the young.
See, I like herring gulls. I'm very fond of them.
So do I. They're survivors. Hey, a couple of people, piles and piles of correct answer. Moira Tui, Alistair White, Bill and Anne and Macduff, Sandy Main, Alice McDonald, John McKenzie, Jim and Paisley, Karen Peters in Glasgow, Dave, Peter, Carol, Hazel in Aberdeen and Fraser in Carluke. The list goes on.
Alistair and Leven, John from Dunvegan, Neil and Dumfries, Alan Breach and Andrew in Milnathaw, Andrew Barry in Roman Camp, West Lillian, Alison and Seymour, Westcott, Brian and Jessica from East Anglia. I think we may have got through them all this week. I'm not sure. Yeah. And John File says, it's the F show today. So many attractions, but of course, must mention shearing at 11 a.m. I don't know why we have to mention shearing at 11 a.m, but according to Joey, maybe he's taking part. I don't know.
Anyway, don't
forget our New Scotland Outdoors podcast, available today at noon. Until we come back again next week, from all the team here in Aberdeen, thanks very much for listening.